Welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Spiral Marketing Podcast. I'm your host, Carl Bohm. Today's episode explores trademarks, copyrights, and the sometimes complex relationship between marketers and legal support in protecting brands and campaigns. Some marketers on a rush deadline may be wary of waiting for legal's approval and their precarious red line. The legal process can be seen as an obstacle, but word to the wise, make friends with a good attorney. Today's guest is a trademark attorney and former rock star that may give you a fresh take on the role of marketing and legal assistance. Enjoy.
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Eric Perot is a trademark attorney at Gerben Law Firm, PLLC. Mr. Perot uses his knowledge of trademarks and domain names to help small and large businesses alike protect their valuable intellectual property rights. Mr. Perot has extensive experience on a variety of trademark matters, including pharmaceutical trademarks, automotive names, restaurant trade dress, band names, brewery and beer names, UDRP proceedings, DMCA enforcements, and more. Eric, welcome to Spiral Marketing.
Hi, thanks, Carl.
Absolutely. Let's just get started. How do you see the relationship between marketing and the legal department?
Sure. So with a marketing department and a legal department, I think it really is the point where they intersect is creating a protectable property interest as opposed to just a marketing idea. So imagine that the marketers are really coming up with all these different ideas. They're really you being the creative forces behind what the brand will eventually be. But a trademark attorney can help turn that from a marketing idea into a trademark. And that is something legally that means something completely different than just the idea itself, because you can't protect an idea unless it's a patent, but you can protect a trademark indefinitely from around the entire United States. You can have it from basically forever. So it is a unique thing that you have to work at it. And I think that's where the two really work together.
Love that. Yeah. One of the reasons why I was excited about this conversation was because I think that entrepreneurs and marketers both have legal questions surrounding trademarks and copyrights, no matter what phase in the game they're at. If they're brand new, then they're wondering, what do they need to do just to secure their own name? And then as they start to get bigger, is our brand campaign good enough that we need to start looking at trademark issues? Do we need to start looking at copyright issues? So I think that's going to be really helpful getting into it.
Yeah. And I think that a part of it is knowing what a question to ask, because I get a lot of people who call and say, hey, I want to copyright my trademark. I guess the language itself starts to get confusing in itself. So I think knowing the differences between them and then also being able to recognize them, that's kind of the first steps of can't protect and you can't invest in what you don't know you have. So that's part of what I do is help small businesses, help large businesses, anyone in the process to figure out what they have, what's worth protecting, what's worth really going for legal protection for. And I leave it up to the marketers and to the entrepreneurs to work with marketing people to actually come up with the good ideas, but I can help protect the good ideas.
Right. How did your past lead you to become an attorney who works so closely with marketers?
Yeah, so I grew up playing music, and when you're with a bunch of people, artists and designers and musicians, there's not a lot of thought when it comes into like picking your brand and picking, at least not when I was in the punk rock scene in South Florida. There's not a lot of thinking about your trademarks, but what I realize is that it's not always the best musicians that get ahead or get noticed and get popular. It's actually, at the time I didn't realize it, but it was really the people who had a certain look, a certain sound, and a certain brand. And that's what I realized when I went to law school, is that all of that is about branding, it's about marketing, and then eventually that's about trademarks, because you look at all of these big bands that can't have other people using closely similar names because you buy the wrong album, you hear a song and it's terrible, and suddenly that band gets a lot of bad press or good press. So I think that is kind of where I came into it, is from that idea of trying to market it. musicians and art, but then now it is something you realize really applies in the business world, because it's all about creating this identity for a business and then being able to invest in it for the long term.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think even non-marketers could see that a lot of great musicians that exceed the norm are great marketers and have great branding. Beyonce comes to mind. You know, she's just a global galactic brand.
She's also highly litigious. So
interesting. Yes. Interesting.
We have been opposed to Beyonce's lawyers at least once. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, what has your experience been like working with marketers so far?
It's a mixed bag, because it depends on what part of the process it comes in. Because sometimes if one of the rules I always say is don't fall in love with a trademark before you have a chance to actually know if you can protect it yourself. And so a lot of marketing people I've worked with, they are very sharp, have great ideas, but then they get married to something or they sell a client on something and that's what they're doing no matter what an attorney tells them. That is always a hard place to come at, because there's not a lot of back and forth. I want to hear what I want to hear, and if I don't, then I'll just keep doing it anyways. And that is not, luckily it's not usually the case, because we usually work with people so early on in the process that we actually can get it before they've invested millions of dollars into an ad campaign or thousands of dollars into an ad campaign and into the brand. So the way that it's worked the best for me is when the marketer can explain what they think that the brand should be, kind of the general idea. They come up with a couple different names would be best, or logos or variations, and then work with me to figure out which one is most likely to be able to be protected and has the lowest liability risk. So that comes with a lot of different back and forth. And then I get to know the brand better too, because if a marketer can accurately say, so this is what we're going for, these are our products, this is the direction that the company is generally going in from a marketing standpoint and the client from a business standpoint, then I know I should draft this application, or we should set up a program for enforcing it in certain places to make sure it's powerful in those specific places. So it's a give and take. So we learn a lot from each other if it's a good relationship, and if it's not, then we tend to have to deal with the problems later, and those are usually much more expensive. But the earlier on in the process that we get, or the people who really are just willing to take advice and go with that, are the people who really, I think, get the strongest trademarks at the end.
Well, you talked a little bit about preparing research, and I want to come back to that. But first, I think it might be helpful. Do you have any stories that sort of drive that point home of setting up with your research first?
Yeah, so this one is actually very recent. So are you familiar with the Atlas Brewery in D.C.?
So loosely,
They're one of the craft beer D.C. brands. They're one of, I guess now there's probably a few, but one time they were one of the three that were open. And this is actually proves both the good and the bad. So they started doing their own research under a different name, and decided not to go with that name because there had been a winemaker that had a similar name. So they were rejected because they did it from the government. They said, no, this is too similar. So they decided to pick another name, and they did their research. They saw no one had registered something similar, and no one was actually selling beer using that name, Atlas, and filed a trademark application. And what they didn't realize is that another company in Chicago, they were a brew pub that were using or planning to use Atlas, but they never sought protection beforehand. So, and this is kind of the thing that I don't know where it happened. Maybe it was just through the market that they actually started advertising little things like saying coming soon, but not really in a wide way. They didn't protect it. And they kind of jumped the gun at that point and started investing in it, and then started using the mark, and then tried to register it, and
found out the brew pub.
So this is the Chicago brew pub that was using a similar thing. So they ended up not being able to get a trademark application because of the DC application that was already in there, and that they had reserved it first using a kind of application called an intent to use, which gives you the ability to reserve rights if you intend to use a mark. But this other company never did that.
I see.
So they basically got to the point where right now they can't expand out of the Chicago market because of the DC brewery's federal registration that says they have notice everywhere. So it is a thing of timing that if you don't really pay attention to those kind of things and start kind of the marketing campaign before the sales, or you know, really coordinate with an attorney to do it right, then you might actually find yourself spending a lot of money in marketing a brand that you can't expand, or you can't go out of a certain geographic area or use at all. And that is something that I know is a tough position for a company to be in, especially a beer company who wants to expand. And so I think that that is kind of, it really illustrated both sides of it, that one company did the research and are at this point, they seem to be rewarded by the fact that they did the right steps. And right. The other company, unfortunately, is now at a point where they're not sure what to do. And you know, there's ongoing litigation now with who should have done what between them and their attorneys. But from the actual trademark standpoint, it seems to be relatively straightforward that the DC brewery did the right thing and did the process they needed in order to gain protection for it.
Okay, yeah, those are two good examples. They tie in perfectly. And so I want to come back to the initial research that you recommend, because you circled around it and even touched on it. But I think if we could just go right through it, I think that'd be helpful. So what do you recommend that a brand do before they come in to your office?
So the first thing is that I kind of mentioned this earlier, that don't fall in love with anything before. Like, just have at least a couple ideas. I know that I worked with a car manufacturer, with one of the, and you realize that they have maybe 12 to 15 trademarks that they are considering for one specific line of car that they go and clear. And, you know, obviously they are, that's a kind of the at one end of the spectrum, but I would say, you know, get two or three that you could live with and that you like and you think are relatively solid. And you can have the one that's your favorite, but if for some reason that would cause you serious litigation risk, or you can't invest in that, or have another backup just so that you're not pigeonholing yourself. But at the same time, you can do what's called a knockout search. And this is something that we do just kind of as a part of a consultation. So it is basically going on the PTO website, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Right. It's USPTO.gov, right?
Right.
I had my internship there like a million years ago. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So no, and they offer a very basic search. I mean, if you know how to use the the bullion, you can actually get it pretty good, but it doesn't really do what you need it to fully clear yourself. But what you can do is look for exact matches. Because if you know that, I don't know, the Allspice Network, you know, something like that, like if you know that it's a specific name you want to use and you put it in there and there's 15 other names and you look through them and see one that's very similar to what you want to do, that's a good sign just to not spend any more time on it. Because unless it's a name you can't live without, then you can do additional research. But that's kind of something to really check into. Another thing to look at would be the domain names, because a lot of people want that good domain name. And it's not as important anymore than I think it was at one point, but it's still important. And clear the, you know, make sure that that's a domain name that's available, because you could have a trademark registration, but someone has had that domain name for the past 15 years and there's nothing you can really do about it. So
Right. The
last thing, just search Google, like do some general. I mean, that's going to be your best friend for seeing what's already out there, because you'll get an idea and even that's more important to see how people are using the phrase you're using now. Because there's kind of the practical standpoint of like, is this accidentally some derogatory term I didn't really realize? But another part is, does it describe what I'm trying to do? Because if it's too descriptive, you can't protect it.
Right.
If it's generic, you can't protect it. But you get an idea for, and that's what the government will look at. They'll look at how consumers see it. If a bunch of people are using the same phrase and it's a term of art in the business, then that's not something you're likely going to be able to protect as a trademark.
I bet you have some good examples of that.
Oh, well, I'm trying to think of some that are not our clients. So it's hard to think. Well, there's like the best ones are kind of the ones you've actually heard of. But when you think about it's amazing that they were able to protect it. Like American Airlines, when you really think about that, it is a American airline. And the only way that they're able to protect that is because they put so much advertising into it that everyone knows who American Airlines is.
Sure.
Then there's other ones, like I've seen, like a descriptive art would be like cheap soccer balls. You know, if you sell soccer balls and it's really good for a consumer to know, oh, that's exactly what they do. They sell cheap soccer balls. That's, you can't protect that. Right. And that's something that I'm sure as a marketer, you kind of, that you would steer away from that just because it is so non-distinctive that it doesn't separate yourself in a consumer's mind. Every once in a while you see, especially with kind of like, you know, the something solutions or, you know, the internet technology solutions, like all these words that are really all just describing the one thing that you're offering are not really generally effective marks. There could be good business tools because they tell you the person exactly what you're looking for, but you probably want to look at something more distinctive or pairing it with a very distinctive logo that would be what you would want to protect.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting, the parallel between being too descriptive of a brand name and legality, because there's another parallel there, which is kind of your branding 101, which is the more descriptive a brand name, the less valuable it is. So the opposite of that is the least descriptive, the more valuable it is, because there are less connections in your brain to those words. So like Pepsi, you didn't have it. There's no gray matter already in your mind associated with Pepsi until Pepsi came along, you know, and Google. Google's a great example. Didn't describe anything, but now it's super valuable because it didn't describe anything. Right. So
and,
there's no.
And legally, that has an analog where the more arbitrary or that's so that is a we call it the spectrum of distinctiveness. That's the kind of the trademark legal. Yeah, yeah. And so there is. It's generic, descriptive, then suggestive, and arbitrary or fanciful. And basically that the ones you were just talking about are the arbitrary. Apple for computers, arbitrary because it doesn't mean anything right within that space. Mm-hmm. And then there's something like I think Kodak, which I always heard the story was that it could be translated phonetically in like a bunch of different languages, or it didn't have meaning in a bunch of different languages, so they knew they could use it worldwide. So it's something that was chosen just for, you know, an arbitrary reason, or and it's a mark that doesn't really have any meaning, like the ones you were saying before. But then you get closer to that, like Mr. Clean, that like, yeah, that suggests that it's a something with the word clean, that's it might have something to do with cleaning supplies, but there's a step. The step that a consumer has to make that connection, but you know that does make it easier for them to know, oh, this will be for cleaning supplies. But, you know, those are, and then you know, descriptive and then generic would be like tennis shoes for tennis shoes. So those can't be trademarks ever and will never act as a trademark. And if you don't police your mark correctly and have people recognize your brand, then it actually can go from a protected brand to a generic brand. And,
right.
You know, that's
did that happen to Velcro?
Right. Yeah. There's Escalator was another one. And a lot of these are still, even to a certain extent, brand names, but they can't stop other people from using it generically. And you see there's actually a huge campaign, I believe, in either the 80s or 90s where Xerox said, you don't Xerox something, you photocopy it with a Xerox machine. Mm-hmm. And that was an ad campaign that they put out and they gave to each one of their consumers just to make sure they didn't fall into that.
It's got so much sex appeal, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah. And now I'm thinking of stuff like, oh, I Ubered here. Like at what point is Uber going to become a verb to describe any kind of ride sharing? So it's something that they're going to need to make sure they stay on top of that. But then again, we also say that we Google things, even if we use Bing or Yahoo. So it is not a steadfast rule, but it is something that I think brand owners always need to be conscious of, and marketers too, when they're creating their own ad copy. If they start to use it in that way and not realize it, then that could actually really be a problem for the trademark in the long term.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good segue. Mention ad copy. And I think that the conversation changes a little bit when you think of campaigns and slogans and things like that. In a previous conversation, we were talking a little bit about how Trump tried to trademark, or maybe he did. Didn't he trademark "You're fired"?
Yes. Yes, he did. But so he did, but not for, so he could never stop anyone from saying "you're fired."
Right.
But what he could do is stop anyone from creating, it was probably for like t-shirts and for, you know, different, maybe a book series or something like that. Someone couldn't use a line of employment manuals called "you're fired," if that's what he applied for. And that's, I think, kind of the good thing about trademarks is that they are so contextual that it's not, no one can get a trademark generally. You have to actually say it's for these goods and services. And if not, then you can't protect it. And there's really no way. Like a good one is with a lot of the NFL, when they have the players, when they do their trademarks, they get these, you know, I'm trying to think of the one that's, I'm just here so I don't get fined. Is that with the is it Marshawn Lynch that just basically would show up to press conferences and just, that's all he would say. And that started appearing on t-shirts. And he actually, I think, filed a trademark for that for t-shirts, because that is now something that he's using as a brand, that, you know, I'm just here so I don't get fired brand t-shirts. And then it might even say his name on it. It might not even say the phrase on it. So I think that, you know, slogans are a difficult one, because you actually have to be directly using it for goods or services. It can't just be a general slogan, which is a little hard to come up with, because it also needs to be distinctive. It can't be something that would be kind of in normal parlance, but it's a tough thing. And I think that's a great reason to work with an attorney, to kind of see what's protectable and what's not, because that might be something that, if it's a one-off thing that you're going to use once, maybe have someone look at it just to make sure you're not hurting anyone else's rights, and you might not open yourself up to litigation through just a single use, which is pretty rare. But if it's something you want to build into a long-term campaign, then yeah, like it would make sure that that is something that would be protectable and that a competitor wouldn't be able to use in some variation for their own products.
I've got a couple questions. One is, can you have the same name as another trademark that's in a completely separate category, or does it need to be just inclusive of all categories?
So there is, you can have Delta for faucets and Delta for airlines is kind of the one I always think of in the back of my head.
Good example. Yeah.
So there is a, generally it's the average consumer would think whether or not one company would make both products. So if you're doing motor oil and someone else does maybe a muffler set or something like that, then that would probably be close enough that they couldn't coexist if they were for the same exact word. You know, there's always exceptions to that, but wine and beer, they almost universally, the law has said that is not something that can coexist generally, that it would need to be very specific circumstances where both sides were only making specialty wine and only making specialty beer that the other would never make, even though legally, like, there are restrictions of what a brewery can make. A brewery can't make a beer and tequila, or, you know, it's all these kind of old laws that those aren't taken into consideration because you look at what the consumer thinks. So name of a hotel and name of a bar, they would be related because hotels have bars. Casinos and hotels related because of the same reason. There's are also complementary goods like wine and cheese, because you would buy them together and you would likely see them nearby each other. And, you know, theoretically, a consumer might think that it's the same company offering both because they're such complementary goods.
Sure. So the spirit of the law is obviously to reduce confusion.
Right. Yes. And to provide businesses the ability for long-term investment. So, but from the consumer side, it is that consumer confusion, because that's how these started. It was basically, it goes back further, but bakers would mark the top of their bread with certain marks, actual scores, and that's where you get the idea of the trademark. And then customers would know we're the better bakers because, oh, I like this guy. He does his mark this certain way, and he was a certain scoring. So then that would be who they'd go to. So it was just basically to provide a distinction for that baker and that, you know, a way for consumers to know who was making the product.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
I can thank my trademark law professor for that one. I'm sure she'll be so proud.
What kind of questions do you get, and then what kind of guidance do you provide for your typical small business marketers?
So actually, can I step back to that kind of general idea we were just talking about different uses and different goods and services? Okay, so there is an exception, and that is for marks that are considered famous.
Okay.
Coca-Cola, you can't do, you know, Coca-Cola motor oil just because it is in a completely different class. And from a normal standpoint, no one would look at that and think, oh, Coke's making motor oil now. But there is the idea that if enough people use a very famous trademark, then that'll take away from the fame. So it's a very high bar to be considered famous. You know, there's probably, I'd say, less than 100 that have legally been recognized as famous, maybe even less than that. So it is something to keep in mind, though, that not to think that oh, well, I can be Harley Davidson wine coolers or something like that, just because that's a great name. Right. So that is something that is recognized. And it does sound like common sense to a certain degree, but it's something that we have come across with all the time, is different logos that might look like famous brands, but for, you know, IT services or something like that, that is just that is something that these bigger brands watch out for and could cause you trouble, even if you don't really realize it at the time. So, and that's just something I wanted to mention, that for the most part, things can coexist, and they do all the time. And there's, hundreds of different people using the same mark sometimes for different goods and services. But a lot of the times that's perfectly fine. But every once in a while, you get these famous brands that break through and are able to get much more broad protection for sure. What they do.
Have you ever come across a situation where somebody mentioned a competitor in the ad? So you've got a competitor's trademark in the ad.
The idea of comparative advertising, it's a very active area of law for sure. And because it is. It's an effective way to advertise. And in many cases, it's a perfectly okay way to advertise, because as long as it's not causing consumer confusion, is from a trademark standpoint really what you're looking for. Because if you're saying this is compared to, like, ingredients compared to Advil,
sure,
then consumers know that that's not going to be Advil. Or, like, compared to the one that I always like, I'll go back to a music perspective, is that there was a label that would put for fans of, and then the bands that sound like that band. And for the most part, as long as the relevant consumer would not see that and be like, oh, that means that they're a part of the same company, or this was authorized by the other side, then that's fine. The way that it gets a little bit difficult is when it isn't that way. So if, like, it works with this other Keurig, and if you didn't know that a bunch of people made third-party Keurig K-Cups, then you might think that was Keurig saying, oh, these are our cups that work with this system. So it is a little bit of a gray area of trying to figure out exactly when confusion would start. And then there's also the idea of false advertising.
Right.
That is same idea of confusion, but it is kind of its own area of law, where you're saying that it can't be materially alter. A false statement can't change what a consumer would or would not do. So if a consumer would buy something or not buy something because of a false statement that was made, that's right. Not allowed.
Right.
And that's, obviously the most vague thing that is so unique to each circumstance. If you're doing legitimate comparative advertising, then that's not something that is usually against the rules, unless you're doing it in a way that's confusing.
Right, right. And I guess there could be slanderous attacks too, but that's a whole different segment of law. All right. What kind of questions do you get, and then what kind of guidance do you give to small business marketers?
So I think the first thing is the, can I trademark this? I always like that question, because it's really not the right question, because trademark is a noun. So you register a trademark, you use a trademark, you protect a trademark. But from a legal standpoint, you don't trademark something, because that is the actual property itself, not the act of protecting it, because so much goes into actually protecting it and making it into a functioning trademark. And so the questions to really ask would be, can I use this in commerce and will it get me sued? And can I protect it nationally? And those are two different questions. And in my practice, and I'm sure from a marketing perspective, if it's something you're going to invest in long term, then you're going to want nationwide protection for that mark. So you're not stuck in just your city and not being able to expand outside of that because of someone else using a similar mark nearby. So from a certain extent, we really focus on is, can this be registered? And if so, will it then cause me trouble from someone else who didn't register it, who's been using it for 20 years? So that's pretty much the biggest questions that we get are, this is a name I want to make sure that I can protect it in the long term. We talked about those knockout searches, that additional initial research, but we do what's called a comprehensive search. So you look at sight, sound, and meaning of words that are already in use or already registered. And that's what the government's going to look at, and that's what a court's going to look at, is whether something is similar in sight, sound, and meaning, a similar commercial impression, and whether for similar goods and services.
I like that, sight, sound, and meaning. And it begs the question, logo versus actual name. Do you recommend two separate trademarks in those instances?
Yeah. So what's called a word mark will protect any use of that word in any stylized form. So if you get it for spiral marketing, then you can stop anyone from using different misspellings of that spiral market, you know, for similar kind of services that you would be able to say you can't use that. If you had a logo that had those words in it and then something else, like something that if someone was using a completely different name, would you see that logo and think, oh, that's the spiral marketing guy? That is when you would want to protect a logo as well. And there's some exceptions to that. So sometimes there's a broad term like Apple Core or something like that that could have some people in closer than that are also registering a logo that it could stop you from getting a word mark. If they're doing something for jewelry and you want T-shirts, there's a chance that there could be some overlap there. So you might do a logo then in order to reduce the scope of what you're actually protecting, but kind of giving you a greater chance of registering it. So that's kind of a part of the analysis, is trying to figure out when to get the broadest rights possible. Like, and we always try to get as broad of a registration and protection that you can under, you know, the restraints of obviously what we can do legally. And but then sometimes there is a legal strategy where you go for a much narrower thing. You go for just the subset of what you're doing, and hopefully then you'll be able to protect it without having to deal with other people who are in the same space that aren't necessarily overlapping but are close. It is kind of a case-by-case basis to see which to do. And generally, and I'll say if you have a budget for it, do both. Do the word and the logo, because that will give you the most comprehensive protection over lookalikes of any kind.
And I'm not asking you to give your rate specifically, but can you give like a broad rule of thumb for what kind of budget a business owner should expect?
The rule of thumb that we use for a trademark that is already launched, if they are not trying to reserve rights, it's typically unless you have maybe 5 or 6 categories of goods, or you know, something that you're trying to protect a wide range of things. If you're just trying to protect a somewhat narrow thing, it's usually under $1,000. And that'll get the process started. You know, we do a comprehensive search. You do the registration process. There's going to be some that are lower than that. And it's good to point, you know, to make sure you're comparing apples to apples, that what kind of clearance they're offering.
Sure.
Because a lot of people will just have, they'll be attorneys, but they'll just fill out the application for you. Yeah, that'll be better than making some of the common mistakes that someone would do on their own and not realize that this needs to go in this box, this needs to go in this box, but it doesn't really give you that level of peace in mind and protection for knowing what you're getting into. Yeah, it's important to look at that, and professional searches will range in price too. So it is something to always consider when you're looking at different trademark attorneys, is when you're getting the really cheap bottom of the line services that is mostly just drafting the application as opposed to actually doing the legal clearance or legal search.
Sure. That's helpful. Well, while we're talking about rule of thumbs, what would be a good rule of thumb for when to use a trademark attorney versus maybe when not to use one?
Sure. So in a perfect world, I would say before anything was released to the public, have a trademark lawyer look at it. I know that that is completely impractical and won't happen, but anything that is used in connection with the goods and services that you're offering could potentially open you up to liability from a trademark perspective, because there's always someone out there that could say that that is, you are trading off of the goodwill of their name and that they've put so much effort into it that you need to stop. And most of the time that is just either people get over it, or they find out a way to coexist, or one side just decides it's not worth it to fight this and we'll spend the money just to rebrand as opposed to fight it legally. So that's what always could happen. But when it comes down to it, some things just aren't protectable. And kind of early recognition of that is helpful for marketers, that if it's something that's going to be a one-off use in a radio ad or something like that, that is not going to be a long-term thing, then that kind of is lower on the priority list of something. The company name, company logo, any kind of really well-selling products or products that are really going to be the flagship products, absolutely must consult a trademark attorney. I mean, preferably before you launch, but before you really do a large scale investment in that, that's something that you absolutely need to clear, because those are so hard to change. That once you're known by a certain name, then that becomes synonymous with the goods and services that you're offering. Whereas an ad campaign is something that you hopefully is not going to be permanent. In the most, it won't usually be permanent.
Right.
And it's something that you can change.
You might hope that it has a good shelf life, but typically, the next season, next year, you'll start to consider whether you want to change it anyway.
Right, right. And the same thing, that there are parts of that campaign that might become long-term, and that is something that to recognize as early as possible, to see what really is connecting with people, and then going through the process to protect that on a federal level through trademark law. But something generic terms, you're never going to be able to protect them. And descriptive terms, you have to have a significant investment in them, through advertising, through stuff like that. I mean, those are things that if you can have a relationship with a trademark attorney that can kind of bounce stuff, or if you have a legal department who has someone who knows trademarks well, I think it's dangerous to sometimes rely on a general business in-house person who doesn't have very intimate knowledge of trademarks, because that could get you into trouble. But it's
What's your guidance for marketing teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think that to know what your team, what area you're in and the specialized things that are in each one of those areas. So if you're doing a lot of social networking, staying up to date on the hashtag law, which is amazingly enough something that is happening, where is use of a hashtag, when does that invoke trademark law? And so there's stuff like that that are kind of things to keep in mind that are always helpful to bounce something off of, but may not be something that you would register. So it goes back to, I think, the relationship between the two, that if you have an attorney that you trust and that you can get some just general feedback from, whether it's under a retainer or whether it's just kind of friendly information that will lead to work in the future, I think that's always a great relationship to have. Because then the attorney gets to know the brand more, because they get to see what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. But then on the other hand, the attorney will kind of at least throw some red flags up if they hear something that could be something that should be looked into more. And so I think that's where the relationship helps, to have someone that you actually know kind of in your corner as your person.
Right. Yeah, that's helpful. And I don't think that most marketing teams and departments... Well, I'm sure that there are many marketing departments that consider legal. However, I know a fair amount of agencies and consultancies and other folks that are in the business that would probably not even think of it. They wouldn't even think, oh, maybe before we launch this branded campaign, we should talk to a trademark attorney.
Right. You tend to get that more with the entrepreneur who's doing both the, or has their hands in the business side of it and in the marketing and in the legal side, that they tend to be
able, don't want
to
get sued.
Right. Oh, yeah. And I think that might be a little bit of the disconnect that you get with the marketing team that has been told, be creative, come up with good stuff that's going to connect with consumers. And yeah, I guess the context of that always should be, and don't get sued. But at the same time, it's when you're coming up with stuff, it is like making sure it's legally protectable for if it is the next great ad campaign, that make sure it's not something that is going to blow up in the company's face.
What is your favorite story of trademark law and the intersection of marketing?
Yeah, so I'm thinking of it from a perspective of when the consumers turn on the company through use of their trademark. So a lot of people, so I'm not sure if there was a hashtag recently, or not recently, it was probably years ago now, that McDonald's did that was hashtag Mickey D stories or Mick D stories. And they put that out there and said, share your stories. And of course,
was there some angry Irishman.
No. Basically, what happened is that a bunch of people started sharing really awful stories about their terrible experiences at McDonald's. And that's what they basically co-opted it. And that, it is less of an infringement analysis, but it is something that you realize that is your trademark, and you have to use it in a way that is an ongoing consideration, that once you put something out there, then it's now can be interpreted by the consumer and can be used by the consumer in different ways. And another one of those is recently, a lot of people have probably heard the React videos. So basically the two YouTubers that I think they're called the Fine Brothers, that they have a series of videos that is insert whatever React to whatever viral video. So they have like celebrities on there reacting to whatever the latest weird viral video is and filming their reactions.
Okay.
And so that it's a wildly popular. Yeah, I am slightly confused by it too, which probably means that I've finally gotten old.
YouTube's just gotten weird, I think.
Yeah, well, and so what they did was they tried to then file a federal registration for the word react as it relates to online videos. And there was such an insane uproar from people who said, well, does that mean I can't make these react videos? Are you going to start filing takedown notices? And it eventually got to the point where they have abandoned the application. They apologized and it really backfired in their faces because they didn't know the right way to do that. And they did it in a way that actually really was a PR nightmare for them. And I would like to think that with the right trademark law guidance, they may have gotten some different advice as to exactly what they should have trademarked or if they even should have filed that at all. And there's other stories like that of just kind of the really the what could go wrong when your trademark gets out there and, or when you try to register something that is just not registerable. And there's also, I think, a lot of good stories, too, of people who are built. I think that what I kind of like the most, and it's not really a story, but you see a business that started as a idea that some guy had for a device on Kickstarter. But and from a trademark perspective, you get to see that mark turn into something that's really worth something. And I'm sure you see that from a marketer, too, that from inception all the way to actual like success, that's a cool thing to see from any area of law. It's something so rare that you get to see that I think that's where trademark law is really something that you get to really have that kind of impact. So that's not really an individual story, but it's kind of just one of the things I always love to see is when these brands really are huge successes and you got to be a part of that.
That's cool. Is that what keeps you inspired to do trademark law?
Yeah. I think it's also just you work on so many different things that I think that in my what you said on the top, that everything from like pharmaceutical trademarks, which are a very small subset and very specific because they have all these rules related to the FDA. But then it's kind of the wild, wild west when it comes to like e-cigarettes or something like that, that like so many people are just like, we're doing this. Like, who's going to be the person who ends up being the next Marlboro of e-cigarettes, which it might actually be
Marlboro.
Yeah, it might just be them. Yeah. But
you
see these kind of new things pop up and so many people are able to get into it and start to build a brand or their beers and their breweries. I always love to see that because they come from such a labor of love that I can't help but kind of get into the idea of like helping out these breweries and beer companies. So
awesome.
I think that definitely keeps me interested in it.
I bet you'd like to help bands, but probably not too many bands come in with a budget for a trademark.
Yeah. Some do. And that's the thing is that you get to a certain point where that does make sense. And there's always kind of copyright things with composers. And So there are some other things that you can work with that aren't maybe filing to trademark the name because they may have other property like their copyrights and their lyrics and stuff like that that would be something they'd want to protect legally that aren't maybe as much of a time commitment either because a trademark from a registration from start to finish usually takes about 9 months. Oh. So once you file, you kind of get what's called priority and everyone after you has to wait in line. But it is it's a process. It takes 8 to 9 months and maybe even longer if you're reserving rights. You can reserve rights up to 3 years after that. So it can be a long process. It's definitely an investment. But anyone who really wants that kind of long-term investment should do it. And
how long is the long term? How long does a trademark last?
So it will last indefinitely as long as you keep using it. The registration itself has to be renewed. There's a 5-year renewal, and then it's every 10 years from the registration date. So you're looking at 5, 10, 20, 30, and so forth indefinitely. I think the oldest one registered right now is, I can't say for sure, but I think it's like started in or it was registered in like the early 1900s. And every once in a while, some of these like ancient ones are no longer in use and they got to kind of file a new one because it's not. But there are a few ones that have been around for a very long time. And there's some of these brands that have been around for hundreds of years and people have heard of them and they've just kind of carried on.
Nice. Very nice. Well, I know we're approaching time to wrap here, but did you have any other tips or stories that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I guess that I'd just say that trademark registration itself, this is kind of usually when it goes out of the marketer's hands, but something that they can think about also that just using it initially and registering it is not enough. That once it's registered, once you have these nationwide rights, it is an ongoing process of making sure that it's being used and it hasn't been abandoned and hasn't been kind of put into a closet somewhere and never used again. And I think marketers can use that by really looking at the prior properties that were available. So look at prior trademarks that they have and think of ways to incorporate that into the new one so that this can be an ongoing thing. So yeah, it might be something that is just like making sure you're using that logo somewhere in the ad just to make sure that it is staying fresh in consumers' minds, because it really is something that is ongoing. And if you stop using it, you lose rights. And so you always have to keep that in mind, that it's just the first step. And if other people are using similar marks, and this is not maybe not so much of the marketer's problem, but if the entrepreneur surely has to think about if other people do pop up, you have to enforce it against those people. Because if you don't, then the next person that pops up, you can't then say, well, I don't approve of this, because there's already been 100 people who have slowly started making your trademark very weak. And you're now you can only do headphones. You can't protect against that same area because you just let other people encroach so much.
Right.
So it's something to keep in mind that it's a living thing that you always have to be on top of and can't just, unlike something like a copyright where you create it and it's yours and you can store it away and never use it ever again. But trademark is something that's always something you need to be considering and using.
That's awesome. It's a living thing. I like that. You can't abandon it. You've got to nurture it and defend it.
I heard the marketing guy for Marriott Hotels basically compare a trademark to a relationship that, like, you know, basically it starts off so like, yeah, you know, the infatuation period, but then, you know, you have to always keep it fresh. And yeah, it was a pretty funny analogy, but I think it is similar. It's the idea of just, you know, you have to keep it going, because otherwise it's just going to get not as powerful as it once was.
Well, this was awesome. Eric, thanks so much for being on the show. The last question is, what is the best way for listeners to learn more about you and to reach you?
Sure. So the firm can be reached at gerbenlaw.com, and that's with a G. And I personally can be reached at Eric with a E-R-I-C at gerbenlawfirm.com. And yeah, I'm happy to answer any kind of questions and talk about individual issues. And I'm happy to do that.
Do you have anything like a Twitter?
Yeah, I have Twitter. It's just at Eric Perot with two R's and two T's. I'm also on, you know, all of that general kind of stuff. But the best thing, especially with legal issues, is to contact me directly.
Sure.
So then I can actually learn about your specific problems, because, you know, that's something to consider, that anything that we talked about here is so general that don't apply that to your own personal situation and hope that it's legally valid unless you've actually talked to an attorney.
Right.
Just to make sure, because
we're not offering any legal advice here.
That was
here,
my way to try to sneak that in there without being too overt, that this is not legal advice. But yeah, that is something important, that each case is very unique and there's never really a like open and shut boilerplate thing that you can use. And I always take that into my practice in every regard, including registrations and enforcement and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's important to know that the facts are always different. So contact me or an attorney or, you know, someone like that to really get a good idea of what your options are and then set a plan up.
Awesome. Well, we will get your contact information and all of the links that we've mentioned here linked up at the show notes for this episode at spiralmarketing.com as usual. And Eric, thanks again for being on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. If you liked this show or if you have any feedback, please either get in touch via spiralmarketing.com or you can go right on iTunes and leave a review. Cheers.